I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For many of us, Saturdays were made so much better with the music of KCUR's Cypress Avenue. For 40 years, Bill Shapiro curated a weekly hour of songs and artists that won him fans far and wide. Bill died on Tuesday, so today we'll recall his passion and his ear for music with friends and coworkers and ask you to share your memories of Bill Shapiro. Then, a look at what can be done for terminal patients to offer them the greatest comfort in their final days. We'll ask why more doctors aren't having necessary conversations with patients about end-of-life options, including choices about invasive care. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Sad news out of the KCUR family this week. Bill Shapiro, who hosted Cypress Avenue each Saturday for more than 40 years, has died. He was 82. Over the years, Bill developed a deep following for a program that gave context to so many great artists that Bill featured on the program. The big ones, Bob Dylan, Van Morrison, The Beatles, and of course, Elvis. In 2006, he added to his repertoire by helping produce Cypress Avenue Live at the Folly Theater that generated more than $250,000 that went to preserve the historic venue. With us today to recall the life of Bill Shapiro are two KCUR personalities with long ties to Bill. They are Ron Jones, who produced the show for Bill for many years. Ron, welcome.
Thank you.
Chuck Haddix is host of The Fish Fry, the other main music show here on KCUR, heard Friday and Saturday nights. Chuck, good morning to you.
Good to be here with you.
And we'd love to hear our listeners' memories of Bill Shapiro and what Cypress Avenue meant to them over the years. If you have a thought, we'd love to hear it. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Ron, what can you tell us about Bill's passing?
Well, it was a shock to me as well as many others, just judging by the feedback on our Facebook post and hearing from many listeners, actually across the country, Steve. So I think it was a shock to everybody. For me, it was certainly personal. And when I found out earlier this week that Bill wasn't doing so well, I was actually given the opportunity to say goodbye to him.
Mm-hmm. So, and what was that like?
Tough. Yeah, it was tough. It was tough. But I did get a chance to sit there and talk to him. I can only imagine that he heard me during the course of the conversation. Bill would move his eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
But it was tough. But for me, it was an opportunity to say everything I wanted to say to him.
Oh,
he was a dear
you.
Friend.
Yeah. Chuck, your thoughts on the passing of Bill Shapiro?
Well, you know, I kind of look at it as in a lot of ways. To me, it's a passing of an era in KCUR.
Right.
I first heard Bill years ago on my way to the airport. I've always been a real radio surfer, and I came across Cypress Avenue, and he was doing a show on Jimmy Reed, and I thought, well, that's great. You know, let's play some Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
And, of course, I worked with Bill, but Bill was a volunteer here for so many years. And when I first started with the station in 1984, it was a very different station at that time. And Bill harkens back to that era because he was a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very proud of that. And he raised millions of dollars for the station, really, over the years.
Absolutely. That's
and it's for me, it's kind of it symbolizes a passing of the era. And Bill was a friend of mine as well as a colleague. He saw that we felt that we were both in the trenches and we were both music guys.
Yes.
And we were both doing radio. And I was a little jealous of him when I first started because he'd raised a lot more money than I would, you know. But I think he was a little jealous of me because I have so much turf, you know, 8 hours every weekend of doing Get Down Radio. And he saw us as both kind of, you know, maverick DJs playing the real deal and talking about real stuff. So we'd have lunch often, and whenever he'd do the Cypress Avenue shows, he'd come in and make a guest appearance on the program, on the Fish Fry. And we do. I don't often work with other radio announcers because I have a tendency to want to take charge. But Bill and I worked very well together,
mm-hmm.
and we had a great time. And he was really loving it, you know.
Yeah.
Doing late night DJing.
Ron, tell us a little more about the following he had and how devoted listeners were to what he was producing each week.
Well, I think a real great illustration is whenever KCUR had a fun drive, Bill would be, you know, his hour or 2 hours would be the high points for the fun drive each mm-hmm. and every week. I mean, the phones just lit up and you know, and that energized Bill even more. And he was just, you know, really dedicated, you know, to his craft and to serving the listeners of Kansas City and to, you know, sharing his passion for music with everybody. And you know, Steve, for a period of time back in the 80s, Bill funded the syndication of that show. And it was on about 25 or more stations across the country. One of the largest stations was WDET. And coincidentally,
in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I worked there about 7 or 8 years ago. And I remember going to a community listening session that we were holding. And, you know, I got up and talked about what we were trying to do. And I mentioned that I used to work at KCUR in Kansas City. And the host of the listening session was at this community center. He said, "Really? Hold on a second." And he went back to his office and he came back with this tape of Cypress Avenue that he recorded. And
yeah.
And I sort of became an instant celebrity at that meeting because of Bill Shapiro.
You knew Bill Shapiro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Let's go to some listeners. We're looking for your remembrances of Bill Shapiro in the wake of his passing this week. 816-235-2888. Mike from Waldo. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to pass along, you know, how important Bill's perspective on rock and roll was in my growing up. And I really appreciated the fact that he dug in, and it wasn't just stuff that would be glossed over a lot. He really dug in and gave the detail, and I listened religiously when I was a teenager in the early and mid and late 80s and was lucky enough to attend a mini course that he taught at PEMDA in 1986. 2 weeks of just exploring the roots of rock and roll and blues, and I just learned so much and had such a passion for rock and roll, and he helped feed that. And, you know, I appreciated the fact that he also didn't just play the artists he liked. You know, more than once I heard him say, "This is somebody I'm not a big fan of, but I think that the story needs to be told." And
just a
passing of a great, great guy and a wealth of knowledge. It was just great for people like me and my friends who really, really loved rock and roll to get his perspective on it.
That sounds good.
Missed it, but I value it, and I pass the stuff I learned from him on to my kids, so it will live on.
Mike, I'm glad you called. Thanks for that good remembrance. I appreciate it. Let's go to Kelly from Lawrence. Kelly, you're on Up to Date, where we're calling the life of Bill Shapiro.
Hi, how's it going, you guys?
Well, thanks, Kelly.
I just got to say, I'm really sorry to hear the news about Bill, but I'm so grateful that he had me play on his series at the Folly. But
oh, this is Kelly Hunt, right?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Kelly
Hi,
Hunt.
Kelly.
Yeah,
Kelly.
Yeah, it's so good to have you here. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I want to just say how grateful I am and to be able to play for the tribute to him at the Folly. And we had the last in-person visit I had with Bill was at that theater. I know he loved it so much. And he supported not only, you know, internationally known musicians, but musicians like myself who are from the Kansas City area. And I'm feeling very grateful today for that. And I so appreciate the show that you're doing today, Steve. And I just wanted to say thank you, Bill. We love you. We miss you.
Well, I sure appreciate it. And coming from you, Kelly, that means a whole lot. We sure appreciate the phone call.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Yeah. Chuck?
You know, I remember Bill would always put me on the guest list for the Folly Theater. And I remember one night Alan Toussaint was in town.
I remember that concert. Yeah.
And it was 10 degrees below zero. And I don't think he'd ever played Kansas City. And it sold out that night because of Bill.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
He was a music curator. And he told the story of these musicians that he featured without being didactic.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
You never felt like he was talking down to you. You felt like he was talking to you, and that's a sign of a good announcer.
You know, what strikes me about him, Ron, and I had the good fortune to be at his house one day and to sit in the Hollywood space in his living room, which was the perfect spot to hear music from his incredibly hi-fi stereo system that he had going on. But his level of devotion to the music was just something. I mean, there are lots of music fans, but not many music fans like Bill Shapiro.
He lived the experience. I mean, you know, the moment you walked in his house, there was a big picture of Bob Dylan right in the entranceway.
And I
think the occasion you're speaking of, Steve, I think I was there with you, mm-hmm. and we just spent like an afternoon, you know, listening to music and hear Bill, you know, talk about how passionate it was. And he always placed the music within a social context. So it gave you that little bit extra that, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of even drew you in more.
Yeah. Let's go to Lisa from Prairie Village. Lisa, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, thank you. I was just sharing that my Billy used to do pledge drives, and you could call in and dedicate songs to people. And my young kids were both big Beatles fans, and he was doing a Beatles show. So my mom called in and dedicated a song to each of them, and they were sort of obscure Beatles songs. And he was really thrilled that young kids knew those songs, and my kids were beyond the moon when they heard Bill Shapiro say their names on the radio. So it was a very special memory for all of us.
That's a good memory, Lisa. Thanks for sharing it. Our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. If you have a memory of Bill Shapiro and what Cypress Avenue meant to you, give us a shout. Victoria from Lenexa, good morning.
Hi, Steve. It's Victoria in Lenexa.
Hey, Victoria.
My story, in 1991, I started dating this guy, and he listened to KCUR. I'd never heard of it before, and Bill Shapiro, Cypress Avenue. So every Sunday, we would schedule our errands around Cypress Avenue, and we always pledged during his time because he made it competitive. So we'd always wait to pledge to for Cypress Avenue. Well, anyway, now I've married that guy. We've been together 29 years. And I'm a volunteer at KCUR, and it's made a big impression on my life. And we miss Bill and love the show.
Victoria, thanks for the good call. I appreciate it.
You know,
I can't help, Ron, wondering how Bill managed to do the show for 40 years. I mean, I can't believe that. I mean, I'm on 18 thinking, I don't know how you get to 40.
That's rather uuncommon.
Yes.
You know, the life of most shows doesn't even come near 40 years. I mean, if a show's on the air for 10 years, that's a great run.
Right.
You know, fortunately, I'm sitting between two guys who have been on an extremely long time.
Yeah.
And, most rock and roll DJs, you know, Alan Freed, mm-hmm. and those guys, they moved around a lot. They didn't have any kind of security, really. Mm-hmm. And some of their careers were pretty short-lived.
Mm-hmm.
But Bill, it reflects his passion for the music.
Exactly.
And also his passion for public broadcast.
Right,
exactly.
Right. Did he play an instrument?
No. You know, I produced a tribute to Cypress Avenue's 40th anniversary.
In fact, it's going to be on Central Standard next week at 10 o'clock, I think, in the morning next week. Yeah.
That is true. And in addition to that, we're now looking for another opportunity to re-air that show sometime in the next few weeks. But anyway, Bill talks about, you know, sort of his exposure to learning music, and he said, "Oh, the best instrument I can play is the radio."
That's where his skill level was.
Or a record player, yeah.
Well, you know, he was very passionate about radio and rock and roll, mm-hmm. and he was there. You know, he saw Elvis on TV,
mm-hmm.
and it changed his life.
Changed his life.
Yeah, as it did for a lot of people.
Bill
and I had lunch together regularly and shared a lot of memories. And like Bill, radio was my connection to the world, and it was his connection to the world too. Mm-hmm. And he was always current with what was going on at the day. If you look at the programs, it's a veritable who's who of the new thing that came along.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and rock and roll is always evolving. And a lot of times people don't keep up, particularly of my generation, don't keep up with current trends in rock and roll. Mm-hmm. Bill did.
Mm-hmm. He had these heroes, these musical heroes, you know, Dylan, Van Morrison, and the like. Did he ever meet any of those people?
Well, he talked about his experience at a Van Morrison concert. I don't know that he met Van Morrison face to face. He met a lot of musicians through his series at the Folly, you know, which he cherished dearly. Each and every interaction he had with a musician, Bob Dylan. I'm not sure if he ever met him either, but he certainly talked about Bob Dylan as though he was his best friend.
Boy, no kidding. You think Bob owes him one for all the exposure he gave him here.
Exactly.
Let's go to Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, you're on Up to Date.
Hello, my name is Chris, and we live over here kind of in Waldo in Kansas City, and I met Bill Shapiro. I used to work at Trader Joe's at Ward Parkway Mall, and he came through my line one day, and I was like, hey, how are you doing, sir? Didn't have a clue who the person was, and he was like, well, I'm doing quite well. How are you doing? And I was like, oh, my gosh, that's Bill Shapiro. So, it was kind of cool. I just kind of chatted with him. It was almost like meeting the celebrity with the name without the face, and then he went to leave. I was like, well, have a good day. And he's like, well, you too, have a good day, so young man or whatever. And I was just like, oh wow, I was like, that's amazing. I met the guy from Saturday Morning Radio.
You know, Steve,
kind of cool. So.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, thanks,
go
Chris,
right ahead.
I appreciate that.
You know, Steve, he would often talk about, you know, like going to the grocery store and saying something to the cashier, and then several people behind would say, hey, are you Bill Shapiro? You know, so.
Chuck, I bet you have that experience.
Oh, yeah. Standing in Waldo Grain, buying pig ears for my dog. And I'm talking to the guy, and the woman
that's
goes,
place. That's
you're Chuck
spot.
Haddix, right?
Yeah.
And Trader Joe's, too. Those kids, we have a lot of listeners at Trader Joe's, and I'm a regular there, let's put it that way. But Bill had such a distinctive voice.
Yes.
You know, and it, being in radio, you know, I always say I have a face for radio. People really don't know what you look like, but they know your voice. And and it shows also how he connects one-on-one with his listeners, which is the goal of announcers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Sonia from Gladstone, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling to let you know how much I love Bill Shapiro. I'm sad that he's gone, but I'm so blessed to have heard his beautiful voice. I loved his music. When I moved from California, Cypress Avenue was something I would listen to every Saturday. And he was so amazing. And I loved his voice just as much as I loved the music that he played.
Oh, that's
so
great.
I'm thankful to you, Steve, for doing this for him.
You bet, Sonia.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for the remembrance. I appreciate it. Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on Up to Date as we recall Bill Shapiro.
I met him once here in Lawrence. He had a program at the Arts Center. He was very nice. And the two things that intrigued me was the first thing that he had a regular day job as a lawyer. He did this every Saturday with all that research he did. And the other part was that I Googled Cypress Avenue and realized that that was a different song that he used for his theme song on his show, but they were both really nice. Thanks. I'll take you off here.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Frank. Can you fill us in on that, Ron, the theme song? And
Sure. The theme song was composed and performed by a musician by the name of Matthew Fisher, and it's from an album that was released back in 1973 called Journey's End. The name of the particular tune is Interlude. So...
And the name of the program is Cypress Avenue.
Boy, isn't that the truth? Yeah. Well, we have some audio here from the special that Ron Jones produced. He just referred to it a few minutes ago when Bill marked his 40th year on the air. This one recounts how Bill's passion for the music got its start.
I was just thinking about when it all began, because I can put a very specific date on that. It would have been Christmas morning, 1942. I was 5 years old. And my uncle, for Christmas that year, acting out Santa Claus, gave me an RCA Victor Victrola that played 78 RPM records. Why he did, I don't know. There must have been some clue that I was listening to something. But I was hooked. Hook, line, and sinker. My mother wrote in my, we used to have baby books, you know. My mother wrote in my baby book, if we let him, little Billy would sit in front of that Victrola in his rocking chair all day, every day. And it's true, I would. That's all I wanted to do. And then there are, you know, those happy accidents that occur the happy accident that occurred for me was that my mom's closest friend's husband happened to be in the coin-operated vending machine business, which included jukeboxes. There weren't kids' records back then. I mean, we're talking about back in the 40s. But he would take the records off the jukeboxes when they weren't being listened to and give them to me. And that's how I got hooked.
That's just remarkable, we just heard, listening even as a toddler. I mean, something clearly was in his mind right from the get-go, Chuck. Were you sitting in front of Victrola as a kid?
Well, we didn't have a stereo in the house, so I listened to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother had a 40 Ford coupe that was parked in a driveway, and I knew where the key was. And I'd go out there and pretend I was driving to California to listen to the radio, and I would regularly wear his batteries out, run his batteries down.
So you had something going on, too.
And the only radio – well, when I go to my grandmother's house, she had – a Victrola and a stack of 78s, and I would listen to those. I would play those when I was a kid and listen to the radio out in the garage, too.
Exactly. Yeah.
Boy, let's go back to some calls here. Let's go to Georgiana from Olathe. Georgiana, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. My reminiscence of Bill Shapiro is my summer and falls in the northern woods of Minnesota in the Chippewa National Forest. I was able to listen to him on Saturday afternoons through the Minneapolis public radio station.
Wow. Wow.
So we never missed him. We listened to him here in the Kansas City area and then up there in the Chippewa National Forest.
All right. That's a good memory, Georgiana. Thanks very much.
All right.
Let's go to Chris from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Chris, good morning.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. Just want to share a quick memory from Bill. And I was fortunate enough to be a personal family friend with him. And he had introduced me to a lot of fantastic rock and roll, I mean, over and over. But one of the things that I was fortunate enough to get on several years in a row was the cassette that was titled Bill's Favorites From. And you filled in the year, you know, up through, 1980s, certainly, and maybe before they started moving to CDs. But just wanted to say how much, I appreciated him, his show, and you guys for keeping it on. So thanks so much.
Don, thank you very much. Good phone call. Let's go to Chris Chris was already here. Let's go to Randy from Lenexa. Randy, you're on the air. You there, Randy? Well, you know, I guess needless to say, there'll never be another one sort of like him, will there be?
You're exactly right. He, he had a combination of a great curiosity, a gift of gab, and a passion for the music. And, that may not sound like a rare combination, but the way he did it, his approach to the music, his approach to radio, and his love and passion for radio and the Kansas City community is rare.
It always shined through, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, sure. he gave back to the community and gave back to KCUR. And he felt that one person could really make a difference in the arts in Kansas City, and he did so in so many different ways.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah, he fundraised for KCPT. He was on the board of the Folly. He did a number of things, just to help out.
You know, and he was so articulate. He worked without a script.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. He would go in and sit down and talk to the listeners one-on-one.
That's interesting.
I wouldn't say make it up, but tell the story as he went along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, our condolences to Bill's family and our thanks for more than 40 years of great music. And just a reminder, Central Standard will air Ron Jones' one-hour special produced for Bill Shapiro's 40th anniversary of hosting Cypress Avenue. That'll be on Tuesday, next Tuesday at 10 in the morning. Chuck Haddix, thanks so much. Ron Jones, thanks for your time. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Coming up after a short break, why doctors struggle so much with end-of-life issues. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you need a little more up-to-date content, I've got just the thing for you. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. You'll get updates on the shows you missed and a weekly column from me. Sign up now. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. On Monday, the fringe benefits a successful sports team has in its home city. Find out what a Super Bowl win for the Chiefs could mean for the Kansas City economy. That'll be Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, how should we deal with patients nearing the end of their lives? Studies are showing that many doctors are reluctant to have frank conversations with their patients who are facing death. There's also the issue of patients receiving invasive treatment that they don't even want at the end of their days. In fact, as many as a third of seriously ill, hospitalized older patients reported getting exactly this type of care. Many patients say no one has even talked to them about the type of care they want. Doctors aren't good at explaining what the goal of treatment is, and they sometimes don't even know the right words to say. It's an end-of-life mess that a lot of people say needs cleaning up. With us to talk about this very delicate situation are John Carney. He's with the Center for Practical Bioethics in Kansas City and is an expert on educating doctors about how to talk about death with patients and families. He's the organization's president and CEO and a former director of a hospice. John, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also with us, Dr. Jennifer Mack is an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. She has an interest in decision-making at end of life and prognosis communication. She joins us now via Skype from Boston. Dr. Mack, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, doctor, this sounds like we've got a mess on our hands. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think that we have a lot of challenges, and the issues that you've pointed out are right. You know, that many patients do receive aggressive therapies at the end of life, and that one of the things that creates that issue is this challenge around communication about end-of-life care and effective engagement in decision-making.
I can't help but wonder, doctor, is profit a motive here for doctors doing these treatments that a lot of times these older folks don't want?
I haven't seen evidence of that. You know, I think that the motivations aren't selfish. You know, I think that oftentimes doctors are reluctant to engage in these kind of conversations out of maybe a sense of even compassion for patients, that they see how difficult this information is. They recognize that disclosing to a patient that that they're near the end of their life is very distressing, of course. Mm-hmm. And so it may be really a natural reaction to avoid these conversations. I'm not saying that it's right, but I think that it can be understandable for physicians who maybe went into the field to help patients live and live their best lives, that having to talk with patients about the fact that that may not happen is very, very difficult.
So, John Carney, I can't help but wonder then, how do we begin to make our doctors more comfortable with these end-of-life conversations? And I can't help but think that if doctors are uncomfortable having these conversations, then good luck for the rest of us.
You know? That's true, Steve.
Yeah.
But there are kind of a plethora, an explosion of resources that are coming on right now. I wanted to do a shout out to Bill Arnold, former UMKC faculty person and medical doctor, is now at UPMC, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and is one of the proponents of Vital Talk, which is a phenomenal program in how to teach physicians and clinicians and having these conversations. So, going back to your first question about, you know, docs are going to go to what they know, mm-hmm. which is, as Jennifer just said, you know, it's going to be what's comfortable in terms of this is what I came into medicine for. And having that—
They came into medicine
to fix people, to cure people.
To prolong their
right,
lives,
right.
Yeah.
And so having this kind of conversation that goes beyond that and saying we need to begin to recognize that people are going to die of chronic illnesses that are many, many years long, and that the conversations need to change over time in terms of you're going to die of this at some point, theoretically, and we all agree to that. So how do we begin to prepare? And there are a number of really good resources that are now coming on with the serious illness care planning. And I know that Jennifer is part of Dana-Farber, and they're one of the proponents of that.
Yeah.
So lots of good resources for physicians to kind of embrace this. And it's happening. It's happening all over the United States.
I was going to say, John, it sounds like you're saying that the medical profession as a whole is recognizing that it's got a problem on its hands.
It does. And I think we have to recognize, as you suggested, that consumers of healthcare also need to be ready to ask these questions. And so some of those resources that Jennifer and her group at Dana-Farber have developed actually provide guides for patients and families to go in with this language, you know, the questions and the words to use that are evidence-based and we know they work, and really begin to have those serious conversations. This has really happened within the last 5 to 10 years. It's really remarkable.
Dr. Mack, I just noticed that only 17% of Medicare patients surveyed in the 2015 Kaiser Family Foundation study said that they had even discussed end-of-life care, though most said they wanted to do so. So I'm wondering, you know, I still am sort of struggling with why are doctors so uncomfortable with this? It's a little bit like saying, I'm a political writer and I'm uncomfortable talking about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think you're right that we should be good at this. We need to do this. This is part of our work. I think that this is multifactorial. You know, I do think one of the issues is the one I mentioned, which is just how distressing these conversations
right.
can be. You know, we worry about taking away hope, creating depression and anxiety. Sometimes we hear from family members, you know, please don't tell my dad about this, or, you know, that family members are trying to protect patients from this kind of news. And then sometimes, you know, even patients themselves are ambivalent about it, you know, so they might say in a survey, yes, I would like to have this kind of conversation, but then they might also say in a direct conversation, but not yet, you know, I'm not ready yet. And physicians who may be trying to read carefully what patients want and may be ambivalent themselves about having these conversations may respond to that kind of message by backing off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, I don't know that that's the right instinct, but I think that these are such delicate conversations that physicians may not participate in them or engage in them in the way that they should because of all those concerns coming together.
Do you think, Jennifer, that this failure to discuss these end-of-life issues, does that failure occur more often in cases involving terminal care diagnoses than simply an older person who's aging and suffering from deteriorating health?
That's a great question. I don't know that we have comparative data on that. I would say that, for example, we looked at this in patients with advanced cancer, patients with incurable cancer, and we found that of patients who died, about 87% had discussions about end-of-life care before they died. So the vast majority did, but oftentimes it was only about a month before death. And so, you know, it just raises this concern that, yes, sometimes conversations happen, but they happen so late in the process that you know, patients may have lost some opportunities to make decisions about how they live their life or what would be meaningful to them. So sometimes it's not just do the conversations happen, but when and also how
right.
do they happen?
And how easy they are to take place. So in a lot of the work that Jennifer does, obviously, with cancer, there's a trajectory pretty much that you can project out. You know, prognostication isn't done well, but it's done better in those diseases and illnesses where there is a, you know, pretty much a path. That is not true with many neurological diseases and chronic diseases of multiple, what they call comorbidities, which is multiple illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really kind of gets back to this thing about we as consumers also need to be having these discussions in our families without clinicians and saying, What's most important to you? What are the things that you value the most? Those are conversations all of us can have with families. And that's what our, you know, the work of the center for the last, you know, 35 years has been on how do you engage people around these important issues, and not so much around the part of I want this or I don't want this, but what makes me tick, what makes me, you know, what's really important to me in terms of my values and my preferences and my wishes and that kind of thing. And for all of us, there's a story inside and there's a legacy that we want to leave. And so those are really important aspects. I really admire you guys for doing the show today and really remembering and you know, kind of taking Bill's contributions and really sharing them with everybody. Because we all have that story within us, and we need to share those. And that doesn't require a clinician. It really is about getting together and having conversations, and that's really the work of the center for helping people say, I can take that story in, man. I did with my mom. You know, we took mom's story back to the doctor and said, we're not going to do this anymore. We're gonna let her go.
The center that John Carney's referring to is a Center for Practical Bioethics here in Kansas City. Maybe the question, John, at some point here is, whose job is it to initiate these conversations? Is it the doctors or the patients?
It's hard when it's a critical illness, when it's a diagnosis of terminal status or really serious illness. I think it's incumbent upon the physician to begin the conversation. It's hard for families to say, okay, what does this mean? For those of us, though, that are dealing with older adults, and many of us are going to die older, I mean, 80 and above, and sometimes even in you know, the century mark, we're going to hit that. We're seeing that. That's really more important for us to begin the conversation ourselves. And there are lots of tools for that as well. And the center has some, and we're happy to share those on our website. But it really is about deciding the importance of translating a wish or a preference or a value into a treatment. That's a clinical responsibility, the translation part. But is it very important for those families to know what those stories are and those values in order to express those so that the doctor can do the teasing out? And that's really the work that Vital Talk does and that the SICP, the Serious Illness Care Planning does. But that's later on.
And then, Dr. Mack, what's the patient's obligation here when it comes to asking questions to clarify a very difficult situation?
Well, I'm not sure if I'd frame it as an obligation, but I would really encourage patients and families to ask the questions that they need to know. I think there's a lot of evidence that patients often wait for the doctor to offer this kind of information. And if the doctor doesn't offer it, they don't necessarily ask. And I think it's so important.
No news is good news, maybe, right?
Yeah. And I think they need to feel empowered to ask. And, you know, also, I think sometimes there's this feeling of needing to defer to the doctor, right? They would tell me if I needed to know. But they need, you know, patients and families need to know they can ask, they should ask these questions that are important to them, because their needs are really the center of what we need to meet in care.
You know, John, not long ago, I went through some of this with my own father. And, you know, you're in the hospital. We got great care. But boy, the nurses are coming and going. The doctors are coming and going. And you have to sort of be a little bit assertive. And it can be a little intimidating and say, I need to understand what's happening here. Can you take a minute with me? You got to really sort of intercede.
You do. You have to advocate not only for yourself, but for your family. And it's absolutely essential that we kind of, again, back to the consumers, we kind of ready ourselves to be able to know what those things are. So some of those tools and resources that are companion for the physicians that we've been developing give the guide for the families to go in and say, what about, and you get your list, you go in, you're prepared. And, you know, we've got some of those resources we can share as well with families to say, it is absolutely essential. And you should know that you can ask for that time and say, this isn't part of my 15 minutes. This is what I need from to make this experience whole for my mom or for my dad or whomever it is.
Yeah.
The family needs that.
And Dr. Mack, the other thing I noticed and observed from my own conversations, our family was pretty united about how we wanted dad to be treated. If that's not the case, then it's, you know, Katie bar the door, right?
That's right. And that's where, it, you know, as John pointed out, these conversations that happen within families beforehand about what's most important to the patient are really critical, because then the family can reflect back on that. They may have disagreements about what they want, but they have some clarity about what was important to the patient. And yeah.
I'd like to kind of piggyback on that, because we now are partnering with an organization that allows us to take videos on the phones for mom's story and be able to capture that, store it in the cloud, retrieve it at this point where the crisis occurs, that it's like, okay, so nobody knows really, or claiming they don't know what mom wants, but you can pull out of the cloud and say, let's listen to what she said. And it really has that sense of refocusing not on the battle that's going on between the members of the family, but let's focus on who that person is and what that person wants. And if we've got an expression of that that we can retrieve and share, it changes the whole dynamics around that, and even for the clinicians as well.
We're talking about this vital communication that needs to take place toward the end of life and how that should be conducted. If you want, you have a question or want to share a story, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dr. Mack, let's talk about this notion that heroic measures are often being taken on patients who are near death, even in situations where they don't want it. How is that happening?
I think, again, a lot of this is a failure of communication, that physicians don't always open up these conversations, and so they don't always know what the patient wants. Or sometimes within a family, those conversations haven't happened, and so the surrogate decision maker, you know, is reluctant to forgo any kind of measures that might prolong the patient's life. There are some patients, I would say, who do want aggressive measures, even though they know that they're dying. And so some percentage of patients who receive care in the ICU or who receive, you know, chemotherapy or hospital care at the end of life are receiving that because they said, I know I'm dying and it's still important to me to try these things. But that percentage is pretty low. It's probably around 15% of patients or so from a past study that we did on this. So, but I do think it's important to take into account that some patients will decide that they want that kind of care. Most don't if they know that they're dying.
You know, John, we're talking about this like it's a simple matter, and maybe it's not. I think the term that gets used here a lot is non-beneficial end-of-life care, and the trick is defining sometimes exactly what that means.
That's true. That is very true. And we now know, we've got good evidence that some rescue measures, rescue attempts for some people actually poses additional risk to them rather than providing them any kind of path to recovery. So we're doing better about that. The American Heart Association, the Stroke Association are all coming to having a set of guidelines, and we need to be paying more attention to that. I'm working with a physician here in cardiology at St. Luke's who's very, very interested in this, and we're taking a look at kind of some of the avenues of sociological and anthropological research that needs to come to bear for these families as well. I'd also like to go back just quickly to a point that Jennifer made earlier. I do think we need to pay attention, as you mentioned, about money and the drivers of this. The systems are aligned for health systems and hospitals to be able to maximize reimbursement. That's just the way that the systems work. Mm-hmm. So there really has to be a very vigilant kind of approach for physicians in saying, yes, we can do this, but we can also choose another path. And to be able to say that isn't necessarily the only way to go. And even as an example, in hospice, we used to cover palliative care treatments for tumors that were pressing on a spine or something like that. And the system was designed when we would send them off for chemotherapy, or excuse me, for radiation treatment, to having them set to 12 treatments. Mm-hmm. And we needed one. We needed one huge big blast to shrink that tumor to give that person relief. But it was automatically set up. And so we had to work with the hospital and the radiology departments and explain to them, this person needs one huge treatment, not 12. And they said, well, of course we'll do that. But the automatic path was this 12 treatment. So I think we need to be aware of those systemic issues, especially on the clinical side, to say we've got to be vigilant about what those offers are.
You know, Dr. Mecca, it also occurs to me that a lot of times when a family is told that, hey, there's a procedure that could be done at the end of life, that maybe some members of the family think, oh, the procedure is going to dramatically prolong life here, when in many cases, that's not the situation at all.
That's right. And so I think, you know, one issue is that we sometimes offer things that aren't likely to be beneficial. I think another issue, which John alluded to a few minutes ago, is the fact that there's often uncertainty about medical benefit. And so, you know, it may be that there's some possibility that a patient would survive an ICU admission and go home and still have meaningful time with family, and yet the likelihood is that they won't. And how do families make decisions in that context? That becomes very challenging because, you know, they have to weigh the difficulties of that ICU admission with this small chance of benefit. And so I think both physicians and patients and families have a lot of challenges making decisions when there's uncertain benefit, even if there's relative clarity right around what they want when things are clear.
Yeah, but it's also true that we approach those of us that make these decisions and weigh these risks, it's far more we learn more, a lot more from economic research in terms of how you know, betting and am I going to win this lottery and that kind of thing. So it's more around the sociological and, again, back to that anthropological way that we think about things, that that's a much better indicator than the clinical, you know, information that the doctor's trying to share with you. It's like, well, but I always win. I always can you know, make this happen. So
it's, I'm also struck just real quickly, John, that there's so much interest in having these end-of-life conversations that Medicare actually offers incentives to get this done, and even that hasn't seemed to have made a dramatic difference here.
Well, we're making it. It's slow. It's slow. But it's I think last year, 2018, or maybe it's cumulative now since 16 when it was offered, about $300 million has been directed in this effort. So we're doing a better job of trying to really help physicians be able to gather the information they need in order to bill.
Terry from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to tell you that I have a terminal diagnosis, and I asked my doctors to be brutally honest with me. And they were, and I appreciated it a lot. It has been hard. I'm single and don't have children, and so it's been a tough row. But when I sat down and thought about what I wanted, I got clear. I hired a lawyer. I've arranged for my cremation. You know, anyway, I just think you need to be present in it. But it isn't easy.
And Terry, I'm sorry to hear about your prognosis here, but it sounds like you were pretty honest with your doctors and very direct with what you wanted.
I was, and I still am, because, my background's in healthcare, so I knew an awful lot before I even got diagnosed. So, but like I said, I think you need to be present as much as you can, and I mean, I've actually tried to take care of my doctor to make sure that it's okay. Go ahead and tell me.
Good for you.
Terry, we appreciate the phone call and our best to you in the weeks to come. I just have 30 seconds left, Dr. Mack. I imagine a patient like Terry, I'm guessing that would be helpful for a doctor.
Yeah, she speaks more clearly on this than any of us can, right, from her experience. I think what patients say is what Terry said. This is really hard, and it was important.
That's the voice of Dr. Jennifer Mack. She joined us via Skype from Boston. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Mack, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also with us today, John Carney with the Center for Practical Bioethics. John, always appreciate your time, too.
Thank you, and thank you, Terry.
Monday on the show, one author's narrative on Black leadership and the need for unity in the Black community. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. We had a conversation yesterday with the new executive director of the American Jazz Museum and heard her plans for what's next for this important institution. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up to date. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.